crackheads, it's Friday. It's a pay-per-view week. You are spoiled because you are here on this show, The Crack Baby. How are you all doing? A big one tomorrow, Abu Dhabi. Isn't it weird when it's taking place in that time zone and you wake up and you feel like everything's happened already? Like, I mean, I'm in Europe, only 3 hours behind these guys. I can only imagine how you guys feel in the US. Like, has everything happened? Did I miss everything? Nah, turns out you didn't. But we do have a fight tomorrow. And it is a heavyweight division that rapidly needs some movement. There are a lot of heavyweight fights, but of course the big one is Tommy Aspinall and Cyril Gane. A clash of European Goliaths. And then we have a strawweight meeting. Zhang Weili obviously has relinquished her crown to go and fight Valentina Shevchenko. And it is Mackenzie Dern and Jandy Roba. And they are going to get things done. Din Thomas has had some things to say about it. Din Thomas, a legendary talking head at this stage. I mean, the media, we love you, Din. Please keep them coming because we need it, baby. Andy Aspinall's also, done some Andy Aspinall things over the last 24 hours, which, again, we absolutely love in the media landscape. But before I talk about all that, let me bring in my two beautiful journalistic heroes. It is Ben Folks and Chuck Mendenhall. Look at these guys. Look at these lovely, lovely boys. Up front, just want to apologize, Chuck. You got a phone call there last Sunday. I was full of enthusiasm, let's say, after a day of sport. Glad I could include you in the festivities.
That was fun. I was glad to hear from you. Although you actually were calling me before the last field goal even went through on my TV. So I was like, oh no, somebody's calling me to tell me like what happened. So I saw that you were calling. I could not pick up the phone. But when I did, I realized you wouldn't remember our conversation anyway. And I appreciate it, though. You look like you're having a good time at the pub.
Yeah, I was. And to be fair, had I not like gone into recents the next day and saw that Chuck, the 17 red Chucks, and then the one that you picked up at the end, I wouldn't have even known it happened. So I appreciate you, buddy. That's what real friends are for. Ben. Yep.
I can't help but feel a little hurt that I didn't get a phone call. I mean, I wouldn't have picked up. I'd have let you hit 18, 19, 20. But still, it was nice to be included.
You know what we need? We need them to start showing the Kraken games on Irish TV. And then I will be in. I will be gambling and I will be very in. I will be very, very in.
You'd be getting a lot of phone calls, Ben.
Like, let's wait and see what we got this year from the Kraken before we decide to reach out internationally and try to spread the gospel there. We're doing okay, but it's been a rough go recently for the Kraken. So I don't know if you want to get on board just yet.
You'd be surprised. If there are betting lines, you'll find that I get very involved very quickly. Can I just say, Ben, before we get into all this MMA stuff, you pissed me off again today. Fixing a fridge? I mean, what else is it? You know, what can't this guy do? You know, you come in, everyone likes you more in the office, and now you're just posting random man wins. I can't deal with this shit, dude. I'm sitting there going, this is a personal affront to me for being useless. Why do you need to do this?
Well, in fairness, I would not have been able to do any of this in an era before YouTube. I don't know, frankly, how anybody did anything before YouTube, because now whenever I have any sort of like home improvement issue or project I want to work on or anything going wrong around the house, I Google the most simplistic, childish question into Google, or like you feel like a caveman trying to understand the modern world, because I'm opening up Google and I'm being like, freezer cold, but refrigerator not cold. And lo and behold, it works. Somebody out there is like, hey, you have a problem where your freezer seems to be working, but the refrigerator is not really getting cold. Do you have this exact model refrigerator? Well, here's what you do. Here's where you buy the part. Here's step-by-step instructions on how to fix it yourself, everything you need to do. And you just do it and it works. It's not like I know how to do any of this stuff. And it's not even really that technically difficult once you get into following the steps. I'm just painting by numbers and letting a nice man on the internet tell me what I should do. And you know, you buy a $28 part, you get your children to move all the stuff out of the fridge for you, and the next thing you know, it works again. You feel like a hero.
Little triumphs, Ben. Little triumphs.
Are you one of those, Chuck?
No, I'm one of those guys who I would have been like, $1,200 for a new fridge. All right, bring it over. Jesus.
That's my go-to, baby. Oh, I can't believe we need a new fridge.
I considered that. But you know what? The thing that really makes you feel so appreciative is you go through, you do all this stuff. Now, I'm going up there, you know, once an hour or so, just to open it up, make sure it's still working. I'm feeling foods that are in the fridge, and I'm being like, that's right. feel how cold this is.
It's got one of those little meat
I did that. You know, you just, you feel so grateful for every little thing now.
Yeah, well, look, I think it's very manly and I think you should be commended for it, although it did emasculate me. And then I was going to write a comment underneath and I was thinking about all your friends seeing this person they don't know being, fuck you, Ben. And I was like, you know, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it today. We better talk about MMA. That is what we do here on The Crack. And what is The Crack with UFC 321? I'll tell you what it is. The heavyweight title is going to be decided, guys. Tommy Aspinall, just look at this guy on the scales. Just gliding around Abu Dhabi. Oh yeah, is it a fight week? I better take off my shades. Sorry, forgot I was wearing my shades indoors. No one seems to mind because I've hit that level of aura before my first title defense. Cyril Gane is there as well. And some people...
Wow.
So I'm joking.
That's the selling point right there.
See, I almost hope that Cyril Gane wins just so we can play this back. So we can play it back next week.
I'm going to you with this, actually, because... Ben, it was you. It was you and Chad who were like, oh, do you know what we're going to end up with? You know what we're going to end up with? We're going to end up with Aspinall and Gane. Boo-hoo. Tell me, has it not picked up your spirits a bit this week seeing these massive, massive men being very kind to each other at every given opportunity?
You know, it always kind of goes this way, right? Where a fight gets announced, and especially when you had your heart set on one. And not only had your heart set on one, frankly, but had the UFC president out there for months telling us all, don't worry about it, it's totally going to happen. And then it doesn't, and we get, you know, something that feels like plan B or C. You're a little disappointed initially. We're going to grumble about it. That's what fight fans do. But once fight week hits, once we start doing the press conference, the weigh-ins, all the stuff, you start seeing the guys standing there next to each other, you get that anticipation built up again. You go, all right, these are two heavyweights who definitely look the part. Both these guys look good getting off the bus, walking out there looking like heavyweights, like you think heavyweights are supposed to look. No disrespect to Daniel Cormier, but there's these, something easier for people to understand when you see these two guys and you're like, these guys are going to fight for the heavyweight championship. And if you're a casual, you're like, yeah, they are. I totally believe they are. Now, the thing is about this fight, though, is that if there's like this sense of inevitability undercut by dread going into this, because everybody's looking at it and being like, Tom Aspinall ought to win this, right? Like, everybody kind of feels that way. Mm-hmm. Just from what we've seen from Cyril Gane, he's 0-2 in UFC heavyweight title fights. We have not really seen much of a ground game or even takedown defense from him. He got out-wrestled by a one-legged Francis Ngannou. John Jones treated him like he was the new guy at jiu-jitsu class, and he is not going to be particularly polite. Everything about it makes it just seem like Tom Aspinall can kind of pick the way he wants to beat Cyril Gane. And so if anything other than that happens, it kind of feels like a disaster. I mean, it feels like the kind of surprise that we love to get excited about in fight sports, but it also feels like, oh no, what hath we wrought by making this fight in the first place?
It's tough when it feels like a given that you know what's going to happen, right? Because from that standpoint, Tom Aspinall should be feeling like that's the pressure that comes onto his side of it, where it's like, oh, you're supposed to go in there. I remember going to Fedor Emelianenko's fights. I know you went to some too, Ben, right? Like back in the day. And there was the same feeling of like, oh, he's going to kill these guys, especially in the Affliction shows when he's fighting like Arlovsky. And then he comes over to Bellator. I remember the Brett Rogers fight. And people are like, oh, he's going to kill him. There's no route to victory for this guy. And obviously Brett Rogers almost rocks him and beats him in the first round. And you're like, okay, wait, these are heavyweights, man. They're thrown down. There's no such thing as a layup in this division. And had the same feeling when he fought Verdum out in San Jose, and we just all saw what happened with that fight. So in this division particularly, it's one thing if it's a, you know, a featherweight fight or something where you're like, this guy's skill set is so superior. I don't know the guy's route who's fighting him, right? But when you're talking about heavyweights, there's always that equalizer. And Cyril Gane, there was a point in time when I think a lot of us were like, he might be the best striker going. Like he seemed like, because he was so athletic, so explosive, it's certainly felt that way a little bit early on in his career. So I know he's capable of springing something here. So I feel like the suspense is maybe out of whack on this. I think it's probably a little bit closer a fight than we're realizing.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that you're right about Cyril Gane. Like, the thing that we thought about him was he seemed to be one of the smoothest strikers at heavyweight MMA. Not that he had that one punch death touch that guys like Francis Ngannou and Tom Aspinall, frankly, have. But That's, I think, one of the things. You're right. That it's heavyweight. Anybody can slip on a banana peel or walk into a punch. We've seen Tom Aspinall go out there and just blow his knee out throwing a kick. So
he was there. Front row.
That stuff can always happen. And yet, at the same time, it does feel like Ciryl Gane needs a lot of things to go right, and he needs Tom Aspinall to probably do some things wrong. And Tom Aspinall doesn't seem like he needs that. It seems like he could decide to stand there and throw with him if he wants to, or kind of seems like he could just shoot in, take him down, beat him up on the floor. And unless Ciryl Gane has improved greatly in that area since the John Jones and the Francis Ngannou fights, it's possible. It's possible that he's improved.
Ben, I just advised you not to do this, and you talked yourself right back into this. You're doing the exact same thing.
I mean, come on. Wait, that Tom Aspinall has, I think that if you're charting a path to victory for Ciryl Gane, first, Tom Aspinall has to screw up by not taking him down. I think if Tom Aspinall decides he's going to take him down, he will take him down.
Yeah.
Second,
I agree.
He needs to get a little reckless on the feet, maybe going in search of that knockout, maybe believing the hype that, hey, this guy's got nothing for me, and believing I need to go out here and make a statement because this isn't the fight people wanted to see. They still need to maybe be sold on me as the baddest man on the planet, the unquestioned heavyweight champion. I need to really go out there and make quick work of this guy. Those are the ways you could get yourself in trouble if you're Tom Aspinall. And it kind of seems like if he doesn't do something to give Ciryl Gane an opportunity, you don't really, we haven't seen anything to this point, at least, that makes you think Ciryl Gane has the skill sets against a guy like Tom Aspinall to force that to happen.
Do you think, Chuck, that he needs to have a spectacular stoppage here? Like, I was speaking to Andy Aspinall, and we'll speak about this a bit more throughout the conversation we're having, because he mentions a number of things that we're talking about here. I asked him about the takedown situation, about John Jones. Like, surely, you know, you're a lifelong BJJ practitioner. Surely you just go in here, you know, stick the jab in his face, look for any entry to shoot a double leg and then go for it. And he was like, yeah, like, but, you know, do you honestly think that if John Jones and Ciryl Gane fought 100 times, like, that would happen every time? He's like, there's no, like, that was a freak situation. Like, you don't see that happen an awful lot. Like, a guillotine presents itself that quickly and it's over. He's like, we'd be crazy to go in and think that way. But he also was kind of like, the pressure we have is like, oh yeah, you're going to have to, you have to win this fight. Like, the division's on your shoulders. He's like, the pressure Gane has is like, you better win this fight or you will never be put in this situation ever again. So it's like, it's too pressure coming from both sides. And in the end, he was kind of just like, but when they're in there, you're not thinking about anything to do with this. So it's just like, are you stressing yourself in the lead? Like, you're just thinking of pure instinct at the time. But I guess what I'd ask you, Chuck, and I want to hear from you too on this, Ben. Like, does he have to win in a certain way here to please everybody? To have everybody feel like this is the guy? Or could he simply win like a Volk over Holloway situation where it's like...
He only wins 50-45. One way, right? So yeah. Far, sort of like he only wins spectacularly in that way. You know, man, I was looking at this just doing the math, you know, like going back, it's through 6 fights, 4 years, you know, he has little bit over 9 minutes of fight time, less than 2 rounds. So by his own bar of excellence, right? Like he's trying to uphold. So I feel like for him to get over in the way that we see him, you know, maybe for people who haven't, and I don't feel like the UFC has done a nearly great enough job of like promoting what a monster he is in there. But like, you know, for everybody to see that in a big show like this, where he is now the champ, I think that that's kind of a must. I think he needs to go in there. There is a big intrigue, and Ben, you tell me too, to see what happens if he doesn't do that, though. I feel like if he doesn't like go in there and destroy the guy within a round, maybe a round and a half, what happens? I don't know. We haven't really seen him put into these positions. We don't really know the extent of his cardio. We don't know how he rebounds if he's getting under a barrage, say in the second round, and all of a sudden he's surviving. What happens in the third? We don't know any of this stuff yet. So I think from like a filling in the blanks perspective, I would be interested to see what happens in that case. But I think from a general standpoint, it's probably imperative on him to go out there and make a statement. If he, you know, like the fights that he wants, those big money fights in these last couple fights of his contract before he goes off to boxing, like, I think that he probably needs something spectacular here.
Yeah, you know, we have a saying over on the Co-Main Event podcast where there are two kinds of heavyweight fights. There's the good kind, and then there's the other kind. And as long as he doesn't win in the other kind, where we go five full rounds, not a whole lot happens, everybody's so worried about what the other guy can do, they don't do much. And also, as
Ngannou,
we've seen
Derek
happen,
Lewis, right? Like that guy.
Right. And like we've seen sometimes where the big guys, they spend so much energy early on, they're not used to being in longer fights, especially a guy like Tom Aspinall, and then they kind of don't have the gas for the later rounds, but also aren't so gassed out that you could put them away. Like, we've seen some bad heavyweight fights happen that way. I don't think that's what we're going to get here. I think that we're probably out of here inside of a round or two, one way or another. And I do think, imagine a scenario where Tom Aspinall, as he's shown he can do, he goes in there right away, takes Ciryl Gane down, passes his guard, moves to side control, locks up a pretty basic but effective Kimura from side control, tap, 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 and it's over. I think that there will be a part of us that's like, well, I was looking for some blood and mayhem. That's not quite it. But it's, you know, the same thing basically that John Jones did in a slightly different way to Ciryl Gane, where we didn't get a whole lot of fight out of that one. It was just one guy being so superior in one area. He can absolutely go in there and do that. And if I were in Tom Aspinall's corner guiding him career-wise, health-wise, all that kind of stuff, I'd be like, hey, let's win and not get hurt, and let's go home with our money and keep the money machine rolling for the next one. We don't need to go out here and prove anything to anybody. We need to win this fight and take as little damage and expose ourselves to as little risk as we possibly can. So I would be hoping that he doesn't go in there thinking, I need to make a statement in this. All you really need to do is kind of finish it inside the distance, show that you are, in fact, a superior guy. Because you know, one way or another, unless he goes out there, levitates across the cage, and knocks Ciryl Gane's head off, you know, there'll be people who are just like going to compare it to, how did John Jones do against Ciryl Gane? You know, that kind of thing is probably inevitable here. If you're Tom Aspinall, you got to put that out of your mind, though. You got to just go, what's my best path to victory? Let's do that.
Ultimate troll job would be for Aspinall to make it look competitive, you know, to try and entice John Jones. Look, man, I'm beatable. Look a little vulnerable in there. You know what I mean?
Man, that's so funny. Beautiful. Like, that's so many people have said that to me. Like, that is the
really?
Strategy.
Were they saying it to you when you were out at the pub until all hours? Because that's crazy. That's crazy talk.
They were like, win just fractionally. So John Jones is like, I'm going to beat the piss out of this guy.
Yeah. These people never saw the fight between Dan Doherty and Captain Turner in Deadwood. I can tell you that much, because that's, you mess around like that, you get your eyeball torn out of its socket.
I remember that scene. Yeah. That was brutal.
I mean, Tom has witnessed a man getting his nose bit off when he was working as a bouncer in Revolutions in Wigan once, he told me.
So you don't fight in Wigan bars, man. As
what was he doing in his role as bouncer? He's standing by watching. And
he left,
like,
he
oh,
said. He was covering a guy's shift, and your man was like, it gets pretty heavy. And he goes, yeah, I'm sure it does. A student bar. And then a man chewed a man's face off, and he was like, I'm going home. Fuck this. I'm not doing this.
Damn.
And I said, you know what? I'd do the same thing. We spoke about people who are guiding Tom's career, and in case you don't know something about Andy Aspinall, he's in a very unique position, and it's very funny. It is a hilarious situation if you know what's going on here, because Tom isn't with one of these power broker managers that, you know, has 50 guys on their roster. They pretty much have to do what the UFC, you know, they're not going to play hardball with the UFC. Here's the thing about Andy. He has one client. It's his son. His name is Tom Aspinall. He's the heavyweight champion of the world.
He's also biased. I know that.
He's very biased. Yeah. That's one thing about him. You got to flag that straight away. When you're talking to him, you're like, you know what? I think I know who you think's going to win, Andy. But here's just a snippet of Andy just doing a random interview in Abu Dhabi yesterday. If we have that, please, on Air Jordan.
Said that you wanted a boxing champion.
Yeah, for sure.
You're okay
yeah.
with an MMA champion, but you wanted a boxing champion.
Boxing for sure. The money is
more money.
Yeah. More money. Why not?
Would that be an outcome for him? No.
He's three more fights on a contract now.
Okay.
So. And I don't want to sign a new contract.
Okay.
Personally.
So that's why, because I asked him. He always talk about keeping your siege to have three defenses. Would he have four? But he said no. It's not in my mind.
Yeah. No. Only one fight. We only ever think one fight. Ciryl, win, lose, next fight.
I'm excited to say Andy told me Tom will be a boxing champion by 2020.
He's out there slumming it in MMA right now, according to the old man, huh?
Oh my God, he is. I think this is brilliant. I don't know. Like, it's just, it's so interesting to have this. And I don't know if anything will be made of this, really. I know he has a great relationship with Hunter. But isn't it so interesting to just not know what is going on here? Like, what is the Aspinall play? And what is it like to just have a manager where you're like, he's going to want more off you guys to a level that you don't even really, you can't even fathom at this point.
Well, isn't this what a manager should be doing for you?
Yes.
Going out there and not just being like, hey, we are here to do whatever the UFC wants and whatever they think is fair payment-wise, we will say thank you and go along. Because there's no real downside to doing it this way. If you tease the idea that, hey, he might fight out his contract and he might look for greener pastures unless you can convince him to stay. It's like, yeah, you're going to piss the UFC off talking like that. You're going to annoy them. But they're also going to be in a position where if you're still winning and you're still the guy at that point, they're still going to have some motivation to want to keep you around, especially after what happened with Francis Ngannou. It would be a terrible look for the UFC to lose essentially a third straight UFC heavyweight champion, where guys are like, this sucks. There's easier, better money out there. There's nothing here. I'm walking. That's a horrible look for the UFC. And if you say like, hey, it's a bad idea to piss off the UFC because what if you're not still the guy by then? What if you're not still winning? Well, if that's the case, then they're going to kind of screw you around anyway because they can. That's what we've seen. So it is a business relationship. These guys, there's so many managers out there, the ones who have managed to become the power brokers in the sport, where they are essentially just brokers for the UFC.
Right.
Their business is just collecting fighters and funneling them to the UFC,
mm-hmm.
and their interests are served by staying on good terms with the UFC, not by fighting for each individual client who they represent. Here you have a guy, he just has the one client to worry about. He also has a little bit more feeling for that guy than somebody who just...
Hang on, why is this Ben? Sorry.
You know, he's not one of 150 guys. Yeah. known the guy a little while, might have to answer to his mom if you screw up his career. So, you know, there's a whole different dynamic going on there, but it's weird how weird it is to us to see a manager actually out there advocating for his client and not just being like, hey, you know, I found a penny stock in this guy, and my main business is to keep him keeping the UFC happy. Like, he's not doing that, and it's refreshing to see, and makes you think, well, we should probably see a little more of it.
I mean, you'd feel weird if you weren't doing this, you know, a little bit. Like, if you look back at just kind of like the stability of this division, you know, Francis Ngannou kind of paving the way, right, going and making all that money against Fury, and then having a subsequent fight, not doing so, but making a lot of money where he doesn't have to fight anymore, right? Like, you have John Jones, who's one foot out, one foot in. He's kind of been the picture of instability, all this. And then you had Miocic, who they were like, nope, we'll just keep him. No, you can't go. Preserve him until we can get him to lose to John Jones. It's like they really haven't had a guy who feels like he's meant, you know, or wants to be there long term. And I think that it would feel weird if all of a sudden you have a guy in a situation right now where Aspinall's in and he's just like, I'm going to play the game. You know, you're in the glam division, regardless of it's played out that way over time. Everybody can relate to a heavyweight fight.
Yeah.
So I think it's only smart, man. It's only smart for them to be seeing everything a couple steps ahead and having confidence, betting on yourself, right? Because that only comes into play if you keep taking care of business, everything he's talking about. So I love everything about that, man.
Yeah, he's a great friend to the Furies. He's friends with Peter Fury, John Fury, all these guys. He would have came up with them. He put his faith in them when Tom was a teenager. He sent them there to be a sparring partner of Tyson Fury's, of course, and that's how Tom got into boxing for a while. Like, this is a guy that's around people who are dealing with massive, massive paychecks when it comes to fighting. So it's no surprise where he's going, like, hang on, what? How much are we getting for this UFC heavyweight title fight? Just going to ring John Fury and ask him what his son got for his last fight.
Well,
let's see how that compares.
And especially moving into a UFC era where pay-per-view is going away. You know, you've got a contract with the UFC, and it's an existing contract where the big appeal of becoming the champion is that you start getting a cut of these pay-per-view events. Now, the UFC has decided we can get more money just shoveled into our pockets by doing away with pay-per-view, but they're not going to change your contract. Your contract still says the same thing. And the if the big bonus of your contract is, hey, you can get a chunk of a thing that we don't do anymore. What, you know, there's you're losing a whole lot of the appeal, and you're it's going to hurt you financially if they don't step up with something to try to make you whole or to compensate for that loss. Then yeah, you have a right to be pissed off about that. And especially if you're looking around at the landscape right now, you know, when Francis Ngannou walked away and, you know, he could fight in the PFL, he could do boxing events. For one thing, he showed you a blueprint for how it could be done. You know, I don't know exactly what Tom Aspinall's contract says and what champion's clause or sunset clauses or anything might be in it, but maybe Francis Ngannou was one of the few dudes who could actually do it that way. But he showed you it could be done. You could walk away. You could get these boxing matches. You could make a whole lot more money, win or lose. Mm-hmm. The one thing Francis Ngannou didn't really have going for him out there is he doesn't have a ton of people he could reasonably fight. But if Tom Aspinall is out there in the free agent market with him, now you got yourselves That's a fight true. You can make. You can make it in MMA. You can make it in boxing. Either way, you can make some big stuff happen there. And even if you don't actually want to force that issue, it at least gives you something to go back to the UFC with and be like, hey, I have these opportunities on the table. You've seen it too. You've seen Francis Ngannou take advantage of those opportunities. What can you give me out of these $7 billion you're getting from Paramount that'll make it worth it for me to stay? That's a completely reasonable position to be in, and it's a completely reasonable like negotiating strategy. And frankly, I'm glad that Tom Aspinall is one of the few guys that has a manager that can and will push for something like that.
What was the number that that Jones asked for that? Like what he threw was it 50, what was it 30 million? Okay. Here's the other side of that, just on like imagine you feel like you have a certain worth and you've done a certain amount of work and they're trying to pay a guy $30 million, because as far as I understand the UFC was fine, we'll come up to your price, and he just didn't in the end.
The Saudis stepped up.
But I mean the money spends the same, but it's like he's getting right. $30 million. Like if you know if I'm making a certain amount in pizza and they're like offering you $30 million to go against me, I'd be, hey man, I'm seeing those dollars very familiarly right into a fight. If I'm worth that much to fight against, you're gonna start to think that you have a bigger worth fighting in general, right? Like that's who you are.
Especially if they're trying to put together a White House fight card that everybody's so excited about. Wouldn't you like to be able to do some British versus America, the Redcoats are coming type stuff out there?
Yes,
you know,
it's absolutely.
Good. It's too good.
Please. And look, just for the record, you know, I'm happy that Chuck is getting the John Jones money. I have happily Tom Aspinall without
Saudi
Andy
money
Aspinall
for me
fighting.
Too, man. It's all Saudi money.
You're speaking about the White House. Obviously, regardless of who wins this fight, there's going to be massive conversations about Jones, Pereira, all these people. Whether it's Gan, I've seen people already talking about Gan being a perfect matchup for Pereira if he wins this fight. Mm-hmm. When this was floated, everyone got very excited and were like, this is the type of thing, like Jones wants to come and fight Pereira. But immediately what was going on in my head was like, hang on, the champion of the world like is Tom Aspinall right now, and he's not even in this conversation. I asked his dad about it, and
so
funnily
weird.
Enough, he agrees with me. This is what he said. My opinion is that that Jones shouldn't automatically be given that fight with Pereira. Obviously, the UFC can do whatever they want, but I think he should prove to the UFC that he's not going to mess them about anymore. With Pereira, it's a different ballgame. He likes to fight and he gets fights done. I think if Tom wins, he should fight Pereira. It would be a great fight for everybody. Do you understand? Like, I mean, I know he's not really gone ham there, Ben, but like, do you understand that position? Like, being like, why are we talking about two superstars fighting in my division? And my son is not in that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it's supposed to mean to be the heavyweight champ, right? Is that you're the man. They got to come to you if they want to be the man. And I totally agree with that. I've been saying this since Chuck was out here trying to get me on board with John Jones versus Alex Pereira. And I'm saying Alex Pereira versus Tom Aspinall is the fight to make, because you get that the history Alex Pereira is trying to make by going up and becoming a three-division world champion. You get champ versus champ. You get all that stuff. Plus, you get to remove the giant, mysterious, unknowable variable that is John Jones. Not only will he take the fight, will he keep you negotiating about it for months and just say, no, he won't do it? Will he disappear on a back of a motorbike into the wilds of Thailand? Will he just get himself arrested? You never know any of that stuff with John Jones. There's so many different things that can happen. Alex Pereira has a reputation as a guy who, when he says he's going to show up, he shows up. And so that does seem like a fight that you could reasonably make, and it would be a huge fight. You know, I totally agree with that perspective. Like, hey, if we're talking about somebody having a huge super fight at heavyweight, it got to involve Tom Aspinall.
Chill, you know, where are you going?
One of the problems when we're discussing this is Tom Aspinall is what, 32 years old, which is really young in the heavyweight division. Like,
it's a
generally,
psycho
yeah, heavyweight. It's like usually we're talking about guys in the late 30s, early 40s. We've done this for years, where the guys at the top are kind of elderly in this way. Like, the right now, John Jones and Alex Pereira are both the same age. They'll be like around 39 around the White House event. It's kind of like, if you're going to do any of those, it's got to happen, right? Like, there's a little bit of a ticking clock on those types of matchups. And I don't know how much that actually plays in. This isn't the UFC. This is mostly just us and, like, people out there discussing these things and the fighters themselves and what their druthers would be. But I do think there's a factor of that. Like, if you're ever going to get this fight or this fight, you kind of you have to act on it sooner rather than later. And Aspinall is the weird novelty in this division, who's dominating it very young. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it just kind of adds this extra dimension that we're not used to.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. And obviously we have full faith in Mr. Andy Aspinall that he will go to bat for his young champion, should he have a race on Saturday. Regards to the strawweight co-main event, you wrote a great article about Virna, and much needed, I feel, as well, Chuck. You know, you've definitely given us something to sink our teeth into here with this.
I'm the only one who wrote about Virna, man, I'm pretty sure.
I'm pretty sure myself. It's a great article, and really, really impressive how many crossovers there is here to Moya's career and how many contrasts there is. Like, absolutely insane when I was reading it. Like, what have you come away with, and has it whet your appetite? Are you now suddenly way more on board the underdog train here with Virna Jandiroba?
Well, it's funny because I remember her saying something like this years ago, where she was like, female, or somebody calling her the female Damian Maia, not thinking much of it. But as this kind of went on and now she's in the spot, I kind of revisited it. I was like, I wonder, like, do they, like, what are their careers like? And it was really strange to go through that, right, and be like, whoa, these all kind of like match up in these strange ways. I'm one of those guys who, like, I was like Damian Maia. Like, he fought, like, totally, he was like 41 years old in the UFC. But, like, he's one of those guys who ages well to me. Like, where you look back on him, you're like, man, what an interesting fellow he was. Because I wrote in that piece, I remember he was always like, I don't really want to, you know, you don't go in there to, like, bloody the guy up or whatever. You just want to win. You want to get them out of there. Like, it was almost like he talked like a pacifist who'd been thrown into this chaotic situation of fighting. But he wanted to get out of there without big damage either way, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know if Virna is quite like that. That's why I think where they're not the same. But what he was saying is, when I talked to both of them, what he was saying is, like, you know, he always thought himself as a smart fighter, cerebral fighter, who kept adding to his jiu-jitsu base and adapting it more and more into the sport, which I think we all saw him do. And he was kind of pointing out, you know, that they've trained together with Virna a couple of times, and he sees that in her. So now that she's getting older, 37 years old, she's kind of shown, like, in her last fight with Yan Xiaonan, like, she looked as good as she has, right? Like, so you're seeing her kind of put things together at an older age. And he kind of, like, in his mind, he was like, you know, that's kind of what I did all the way up until I couldn't compete anymore. And to me, that was the greatest parallel between the two. And in a career that had quite a few of them, as it turns out.
Yeah, it's great stuff. But I will say, the fear I have when I'm reading it, and Ben, I'd love to hear your take on this, is Virna, for the most part, dominates people on the ground. Guess where, yeah, Mackenzie Dern wants this fight to go?
Yeah. And that is a thought that, I mean, for one thing, maybe that tells you, hey, you won't have to convince this person to fight on the ground with you. You will be able to to have that kind of a fight if that's the kind of fight that you want. And then you'll just have to find out whether or not you're right about it being to your strengths or not. The thing with Mackenzie Dern is she's such an unpredictable fighter at this point. Like, we've seen her sometimes show up and you go, man, Mackenzie Dern, she's really making some improvements. She's rounded out the game. She looks a lot better this time. She could really turn into something. And then we've seen her show up and be like, she's taking steps backwards. She seems like she's getting worse. And now, you know, she's put a couple wins together and everything, but it's really hard to know what to expect from her, both in terms of just, like, execution, game plan, all that stuff. That's what makes this one a tough one to call for me, honestly. It's just like not only trying to figure out where the fight's going to be contested and who's got the advantage there, but just like which Mackenzie Dern do you get?
Yeah. I just think she has a magnificent guard. Like in terms of like MMA these days, you don't see guard players that, you know, that potent anymore, where you are able to snap up submissions from that position and you're constantly active in that position. But that said, like, Xandy Roba is not like a slouch on the feet either. We've seen her bust people up, as you noted in the article, Chuck. Like, I think that might just stick a jab in Mackenzie Dern's face here and make it awkward as fuck. Like, I think she can absolutely do that. We love Dean Thomas. I mean,
I knew where this was going.
Ben wrote a mailbag piece a few weeks about talking about, you know, the heavyweight division, the relevancy of the heavyweight division should anything happen. Din's gone and checkmated you here with this one. Do we have the clip, Jordan, or do we have a quote? I don't know what we have here. Has there ever been a more insignificant title fight in UFC history? Asked Dean Thomas on the title fight podcast. I can't see the rest of that. It has a sign in front of it. Tell me what it's called, please.
Jordan. On Paper Podcast.
On Paper Podcast. Sorry. Yes. You know, this guy's meant to be Dana White's friend, Chuck. Like, surely not what he wants his bestie saying in the lead.
It's hilarious that Dean keeps saying shit like this, man.
I love it.
I know.
What was the first one? Hang on. The first one was
yeah, they should make the trade. Yeah.
PFL. Yeah. Okay, yes. Fantastic.
I like that Dean Thomas is speaking his mind on it, but it does raise a good question. Okay, I don't see the fight quite like that. I don't see it as that bad. I do understand that, like, when somebody vacates the belt and you don't have obvious, you know, there's just not obvious people that should be, like, getting up there, been waiting forever, that can seem more insignificant, you know? But I remember writing an article once when Joe Soto fought, I think it was Dillashaw, right, at UFC 177, and Joe Soto was nowhere within the vicinity of a title shot, but somehow he got it because of the way the card, like, there was 11th hour injuries and all that stuff, and he ends up on that. To me, that's like a crazy insignificant, like, what is going on here? This doesn't even, like, what is this? This isn't really even like a title fight, you know? I mean, and if you went through the course of that sort of thing, I'm sure that you could find a bunch of others. I'm just pointing out that there's been some absurd ones over the years. To me, this is really... Like, dude, there's all kinds of weird parallels, too, with, like, you know, Abu Dhabi being, like you mentioned, it's a jiu-jitsu thing. Abu Dhabi and the jiu-jitsu kind of correlations that are going there. You know, I was mentioning that Damon Maya was on the first Abu Dhabi card at UFC 112, you know, that fiasco against Anderson Silva. But I think that, like, when you have two people who are, like, when styles make fights, but their styles are so nuanced, you know, like, to me, that's fascinating. And like Ben said, there's such an erratic nature to the way that Dern has fought. You don't know what you're getting. I think that, I mean, and maybe I'm the only one, this is why I wanted to write about it, though, is like, I feel like it's a very compelling fight, if nothing else. Maybe it doesn't strike, like, maybe it's not going to move the needle in the broader world, but doesn't need to because you already have the heavyweight fight at the top here.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely get what Dean Thomas is saying, because it's like, anytime you take two people, neither one of whom are the champion, have been the champion, or were even really in that serious a discussion as somebody we were looking at and being like, this person has championship material, they're going to be a champ soon. You have those two people fight for a vacant title, especially while we do have a dominant champion in the division. She's just away on other business. And so it's kind of just like, who wants to sit in the big chair while she's gone?
Yeah.
When she gets back, you will probably have to get out of the chair. Understand that, but while she's gone, the two of you can decide who is the best, not even of the rest, but of the two of you who we've chosen. And that is what this is. And somebody asked in my mailbag this week, they're like, which is the more insignificant, you know, kind of vacant title fight in that sense, this one or Raquel Pennington versus Myra Buena Silva? And I was like,
doozy.
And I was just like, you know what, I forgot that
That's
happened.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
What does that tell you?
Yes.
You know, and this feels like very easily you could wind up in a situation where this a year from now, a year and a half later, you know, Zhang Weili comes back, whatever happens there, you could very easily be like, hey, remember when the title fight in the strawweight division was Mackenzie Dern and Virna Jandiroba? You know, like, man, you could easily see us looking back on
that
it
was a bad
the same
one.
Way.
Like, what was the, who was the, there was somebody who had a champion, like, they won the belt. They never ended up defending it. It was a women's champion. You know what I'm talking about? It's like,
are you talking about the Iron Lady?
Yes.
Durandamy?
Jermaine Durandamy.
That's yeah. Maybe is that the one I'm thinking of? Because there was a couple of different things back in those
days.
That
she felt won like, it when we still had a featherweight title. She won it, but then kind of immediately announced that she would not fight Chris Cyborg.
Right.
And they were like, well, then forget this championship stuff.
That's right.
And she was a champ for like 2 months.
But we've been dealing in some weirdness in the women's ranks for a while. There's been a couple of other ones too, but man, that Rocky Pennington one, like, that's a great shout out. See, I would put this one above that. Just automatically. But we'll see. Like, if we're talking next year and this is brought up and we're like, hey, we forgot all about that fight, I guess they were, equal.
I do appreciate, though, when you see them both show up for a press conference today, everybody's getting to do their stuff. Mackenzie Dern looks like she's walking the red carpet, looks like she's headed to the VIP section at the club. And Virna Jandiroba shows up looking like the visiting ceramics professor at a liberal arts college who everybody is like, she's so cool. I want to do anything stupid in front of her. And the two of them are standing there and you're just like, yeah,
ceramics.
this is a great contrast here. I'm into it. Yeah. Way to set the scene.
Ben, you have a brilliant article up with a lot of the training partners of Duke Rufus, a man we lost last week, an absolute legend and pioneer of this sport. Some great stuff in here. What have you gathered from his close friends, training partners, since his passing last week?
Yeah, you know, it was so sudden and unexpected. And it feels like we've had a few of these in the MMA community recently. And it just keeps coming. I hope that this is the end of it. Because it's just, you know, I was at the University of Montana Grizz hockey game last Friday night, and I started to get, you know, texts where people are like, have you heard this Duke Rufus news? And when you get that, you know, it's not probably good news, you know. And it was like, people were telling me, hey, we were texting him earlier today, and then, you know, he didn't show up for something he was supposed to show up for. People went, how, that's weird. And then he didn't show up to pick up his daughter, where that's when people were like, well, something's wrong, because otherwise he would absolutely be here. And I think a lot of people really reeling in how sudden that loss was. And when I started to think about it and started to reach out to people I knew who at one point had been Rufus Sport guys, there's a ton of them. You know, when the both Pettis brothers, you know, Ben Askren, CM Punk came through there, Tyron Woodley had been there at a time. Ben Rothwell, the BKFC heavyweight champion, my personal friend, retired fighter Danny Downs, had started his career and had that, like, a really influential person had been Duke Rufus for him. And I think it was also sort of tricky for some of those people, because we saw some people who left there with hard feelings one way or another. You know, there were some people who, like, looked back on their time there and had some bitterness about whatever happened. They felt like maybe the light that he shined on them, somebody else got later on. He decided, you know, that somebody else was the favorite after that. And so there are some guys I know who are still sitting around, and we're hoping that one day, you know, me and Duke will be able to sit down and we'll be able to work some of this stuff out and let bygones be bygones, because they did remember, especially with time, he was a really important person in their careers and in their lives. And then when something like this happens, they kind of all realize you're never going to get that chance now. That opportunity is gone. You're never going to get to talk to him again. And I think it was some complicated feelings for some of those guys and really hit them pretty hard. But also, I think when they reflected on it, made them all kind of realize, like, yeah, your career would have been different. Your life might have been different if Duke Rufus hadn't been a part of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, it was a great article, Ben. I had the pleasure multiple times of going out there to Rufus Sport and talking to different fighters, both Pettis brothers. I did a Ben Askren piece back in the day out there with them, and CM Punk one time. I went out there when he was just getting involved, and every single time Duke was like, do it at the gym, come over here, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I would go over there, and he would always have a, you know, big conversation with you. Like, he'd be the last guy there, and you're still talking to him. I remember one time, I don't remember which piece it was, but he started talking about Ong Bak, which is a movie from back in
Tony
the day.
Tony Jaa.
Dude, and he was so into it. And I was like, I gotta, it was like the type of thing where you're like, I'm going to have to go rent this film again because it'd been so long since I'd even thought of it, you know. But he saw stuff and things like that. And like you're mentioning, man, like he kind of, it's just one of those, you talk to anybody, you know, the agents, you know, the matchmakers, anybody, and it's all facets of Duke Rufus, right? Like they all have different stories about this guy. and what he meant and what he was like to deal with. And I remember like Pascal, what was his name? Krause back in the day, like, and yeah. Chico came as the, there, he had so many dudes like Eric Koch. Remember that guy? Like all yeah. these early guys. And it just felt like he was, you know, in the Midwest, he made himself like the centric, you know, champions, you know, haven for guys who, anybody who wanted to be among them were going up to Milwaukee. And I remember him using the words emotionally connected to his fighters. Ariel had mentioned this where he was like in the Anthony Pettis, I think it was the Charles Oliveira fight, where he's like, you know, if he loses this, I would quit coach. I don't want to keep coaching. Like he was so emotionally connected. He said this something very similar to me when he was dealing with Phil Brooks, CM Punk. He was like, you know, man, I've known this guy for a long time. We're friends first. I knew this guy for years as a friend before I ever decided to be his coach and all this. But it meant so much to him, and we know how that worked out. But it was a tremendous blow for him, you know, to go through that whole process and not get Phil Brooks' first win or a UFC win. And he was very, you know, he was very affected by that. And I think that that tells you a little bit about the kind of rapport he had with his guys in his gym. He was emotionally connected to all the guys that he was bringing to the octagon.
Yeah, I also thought when, you know, and I put it in the story there, when I talked to his longtime business partner in the gym and in the local events in Milwaukee that they would promote, Scott Joffe, and he was saying how when they kind of first teamed up to open the gym and how they were going to brand it and do everything, the only rule that Duke really set out for him was he was like, all right, you can, you know, you're the business side of this thing. I just ask that you never say no to me when I say I'd need to buy some equipment for the gym. Don't ever get cheap on that, you know? And he was just like, you know, and I asked him, I was like, did it ever come up as some tension in the relationship? And he said, well, it made me glad that we weren't in car racing, you know, where, because he did want some equipment from time to time, yeah. But it was reasonable. We could swing the cost and everything. But, it, you know, that tells you like that was his priority, where he was just like, this gym needs to be as best possible version of itself. So give me the tools that I need to do that, you know, and then we'll work from there.
I certainly don't have a personal relationship with Duke or anything like that, but he did have a great personal relationship with Niall McGrath, a guy I used to do a podcast with, Eurobash. And when he came to Ireland, I had no idea, you're speaking about this compassion, the level of understanding he had of Irish history. And it turned out when he was a kid in Milwaukee, a lot of kids from West Belfast during the Troubles used to be sent out there for the summer to give them a break from this war-torn area they were living in. Duke Rufus made friends with all of them, and he started learning about Irish culture and therefore became a huge Glasgow Celtic fan. So every time he came to Ireland, he would be wearing Glasgow Celtic tops and just trying to meet as many people affiliated with this club as possible. When he passed, I find out we have a great mutual friend in Chris Bungard, the fighter, who would send Duke Rufus the results of all the Celtic matches all the time. He had been to Celtic Park, had been brought out on the pitch at Celtic Park in Glasgow. Just an incredible reach the guy had. And honestly, the only thing I'll say, like when you met him, it's rare to meet someone who loves fighting that much. Like he will talk to anyone about fighting. I had another message from a friend who said, I once sent, and he's a hobbyist, a pure hobbyist, never had a competitive fight. I once sent Duke Rufus a video of my kicking technique and he sent me back a 5-minute breakdown on how I can improve it. So an absolute gent. Please go and read Ben's article on Uncrowned. It is fantastic. Rest in peace, Duke Rufus. And we are back, ladies and gentlemen. And look, UFC 321, it's going to be coming at you quick and fast tomorrow. You're going to wake up. You're probably going to miss a few fights. It's going to be happening that early. But we're going to have a live watch-along. GC and Rick will be doing that. And then it will be me, Chuck, and Ariel Awani for the post-fight show. Lord knows there'll be a lot to talk about coming off the back of this event in Abu Dhabi. There has been a few news items that have crossed Peter Carroll's desk in the last few days, one of which was Dana White giving Adam Cattrall the big spiel about what can we expect from Paramount. Very vague, right? I'm going to be honest. Let's just roll the clip and then we'll see if we can take anything away from this.
Do you think fight fans get more?
You think what?
Do you think fight fans get more events in 2026?
Well, I don't know. Definitely not more events, but definitely try some new things as far as scheduling goes.
Okay. Regarding locations that obviously and territories that you visit, it's been great recently, especially with fight nights and the big events that we've had back in front of the fans and packed out stadiums and arenas around. Are there new territories that you're looking to explore? with the
Nadim? Always. I mean, that's always, no matter who we're with. No matter what network partner we're with, we're always trying to go to new places and open up, you know. And again, I've been saying for a while, too, we got to get back to some places that we haven't been. We just went to Chicago. We hadn't been there in a long time, and it was a great event. But the answer is yes. That's always yes, no matter who we're with.
Yeah, it's scheduling. That's a very loose word, I'd say. Thank God there's not more events, because fuck knows.
Did you say scheduling or scheduling?
Oh.
Which word did you go with?
Scheduling, I think. What do you
say? I didn't know what the Irish. I'm sorry to interrupt. I was like,
I want to know. No,
we say scheduling out here. I mean,
scheduling.
Yeah.
Who says schedule? What was the other
scheduling
one?
Is how they say it in UK. England, right? I thought you're from. I was getting confused with the Brendan Schaub thing. I thought you're from UK for a minute there.
Oscar Losa, the screaming scheduling. Right now. What do you think he means, lads? Like, he didn't say. Like, he said he spoke for a minute, but he said things about scheduling. Is this? Do you think, Chuck, this is like the WWE thing? Scheduling.
You don't know anymore. I don't know, man. I honestly don't know what he means. I'm glad, first of all, that there aren't any more. They won't be more events. I mean, that would have been alarming. Because aren't they already doing it? Like, I think that wasn't it like 46 events in the course of a year. I mean, that means you get what, 6 weekends where there's not a UFC event. So if they said there was gonna be more events, that would have been problematic. But I don't know. I don't know if that means they're gonna experiment with, you know, midweek type things, or you know, like they used to back in the day. They had some strange dates that they threw out there. Maybe that's what he's talking about. But I'm okay with whatever they do, so long as there aren't more events.
I think that's fair.
We also, we have to consider the possibility that he's just saying stuff.
Yes.
Right? That maybe he doesn't even totally know what he means. Like, I mean, you see him just in some of these interviews, the tone and everything, like he seems kind of bored being president of the UFC at times. And so if we're going to do anything different with scheduling, I would think what we mean is, we're going to go different places, try to open up new markets, and maybe sometimes when we're in some of these international markets, if we're not worried about selling pay-per-views, we do more events that are prime time for those markets and let other people figure it out. Like kind of what we're doing this weekend. But, you know, like we've seen sometimes where it's like, all right, if we're in this place and we're going to make the Australians still wake up on Sunday morning and come on down to the arena because we got to sell pay-per-views back home at, you know, 10 o'clock Eastern in North America, you don't really have to do that quite as much if you're not worried about selling pay-per-views. I would think that when it comes to stuff like that, Paramount's probably going to get to have a large say in what we do there, because they're the ones paying all the money. They're the ones who are going to be trying to use it to gain subscribers. And in order to make this not a huge economic folly for them, they need to gain a lot of subscribers with this, and probably fairly quickly. But I would think that would be more what he means. The UFC seems to have settled into an approach in a lot of ways where they go, hey, it ain't broke. Everything we're doing, we're making a ton of money. The machine is rolling on really well. I don't see them messing with it too much if they don't have to, and let the TV partners not leaning on them too, because they kind of have the attitude now that they have learned everything there is to know about fight promotion, and we're just going to keep doing that until the money machine stops spitting out cash.
Yeah, that's so accurate. It's very depressing, actually, Ben.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
He's just saying stuff, you know?
Yeah. Well, you got to say something there, right? Because it's like, hey, new broadcast deal heading into 2026. Yeah. Big changes afoot, right? You can't be like, no, we're going to keep doing the same old shit. Like that's like a little bit of an anticlimactic.
We might do things like that. Go back to
That's a little bit of an anticlimactic answer. You got to be like, oh, shush, man, big stuff. People are their minds are going to be blown in 2026. Just wait.
This is how he got us in trouble with the UFC 300 video. I ended up in that black and white thing where I was like, I'm not really that impressed. He's like, fuck you, Irish. Have that.
Well, the thing we've learned, the thing we learned, especially from his video where he was talking about how he was always right about the pandemic and everything, and he would cut Ariel's stuff up. He will make those videos whether you actually say it and mean that or not. They're not afraid to completely take it out of context and twist it to mean whatever they need at the moment. So don't even worry about it.
The boredom thing is real as well. Like, we saw the shock to the system he got in several interviews in that boxing junket he was on and the press conference there. Like, when you can answer every question with, like, yeah, it's going to be great.
Like, you do, you know, you've been sitting there for 3 hours reeling the broadcasts in, just being like, yes, again, really great news. You probably do. You need to shake things up a bit. Locations, come on, it's who's paying for it? Let's be real.
Yeah.
We've had another video of Conor McGregor. I thought he was a religious man already. Turns out, become a bit more religious and has a great tan, but I will say, very clear eyes for the first time in a very long time. Let's roll the footage.
Do you feel that there is a connection between your journey and the spirit of BKFC in some way?
For sure, for sure. I'm not here. I am not here just by chance. There is a higher power, God, that dictates my journey and all of our journeys. And I live my life by God's word. And since around that time that you mentioned at the last event, I've engaged on a spiritual journey. And I'm saved, I am healed. And you know, on the back of that, the world is in for a treat. The world is in for a treat. My competitive spark that was once in my heart is now a roaring blaze. So I'm very excited. You know, I envy these men up here on this dais. They're right about to make weight, and they're to go in and enjoy and entertain and do what they were called to do, as am I called to do it. And you know, I'm eager to get back. And right now, I had to dial myself in and go inward, and that I've done. And I'm very, very excited to come back my own self.
He's gone inward. How do you feel about that joke?
I mean, it is interesting. I think the big takeaway there, Tweetsy, is what you just said about him being clear-eyed. It does seem to me, at least, like he's going to remember saying this stuff in the morning. So that's a bonus, I think. But if God has always been in control of this man's career, he was asleep at the wheel for a large portion of the last few years. I don't know. Of all the wrinkles I thought that he'd come back with as he's nearing, I guess, whatever this is going to be, I did not have this one on my bingo card here.
Well, we've seen this before from other celebrities who have, in the wake of a lot of credible sexual assault allegations, have been like, but I'm healed now. I mean, Russell Brand is out there baptizing people in the river immediately. And so
sells amulets as well.
Well, there you go. a more cynical man might see this as a refuge of the scoundrel kind of situation. If he says, you know, it's a genuine spiritual journey and awakening that he's been on and that it's been good for him, then I'm happy for him. Good. I'm glad. There's something about the affected speech of it all that kind of gives the air of somebody who wants you to believe that he has undergone like a spiritual transformation. And he's that part is a little weird. It also seems like the kind of thing where, say, hey, my sins are washed clean, so therefore you guys can stop bringing it up. That, you know, you want to believe if it's helpful to him, if it's good, then it's genuine. That, hey, good, whatever helps you live a better life and not be a terror to those around you, then that's a net positive. I would say my own personal take on it is we'll see.
Yeah,
we will see, won't we?
Yeah,
like he's referencing, like, when you saw me those weeks ago, it was just like 3 weeks ago. You know, he's talking about, he was with Ariel and the BKFC documentary that Casey did. Absolutely tremendous, by the way. Go and watch that. It's, everybody's watching it, by the way. All of my friends are onto me about it. Incredible stuff. But when I was looking at McGregor and that, I was like, man, he's had a few, to say the least. You know, to say the very least, he had a few that day. And it is the most sober he's looked in a very long time, which is promising because, you know, it was becoming quite regular where he was going to press conferences, he was showing up at events, and you were like, yeah, definitely had a few again. And look, I'm known to have a few myself. There's no heroes here, but different levels, I would say. So look, promising thing that appears to be sober, I guess, but I still think I saw a lot of people sharing this, like, oh, well, he's definitely going to fight now. And I'm like, mate, like, it is a long way off that. And 3 weeks is a very short amount of time. He has to get through a fight camp. I'd say it is more promising based on that 10-minute press conference he did, but
Yeah, we will have to wait and see.
If anything, if he even came close to some sincerity there, kind of like, you know, having this kind of FOMO or whatever he's having, where he's like, the guys over here are getting ready to fight. I'm not getting ready to fight. That felt a little sincere, at least.
Yeah, that's like what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I haven't seen the sincere version of him in a long time where he's saying something that you know he means.
And I believe that, like, I haven't known the guy from way back. I haven't spoke to him in about 10 years. But he loved fighting and really loved that and was absolutely, it absorbed every minute of his life. He was just transfixed by fighting. So he always thought that was real. I never thought for a second that the guy did not want to fight. It's getting to a fight. That's what I think his real problem is. Getting and having that discipline to stay on course for eight, like, I think it has to be more than 8 weeks now. I was talking to a lot of retired pros about this in terms of, like, how far he's, how much he's taken off. And how what would a camp look like if he was going to get back in? One of the guys, and fought at a very similar level to Conor. I don't want to give away who it was, but he was like, I would need a 6 month camp to get ready for an eight week camp. Like, he's like, my life is so different. Like, I would need so much. And he's like, can he do that with all the legal stuff happening? With all, you know, there's a lot of shit going on in Conor McGregor's life right now. Can he actually do that? Like, that is my concern more than anything.
Yeah, I've heard fighters say this and phrase it this way, and it's a thing that I have thought of before in my own life, where they're like, you get to a certain point, you got to get in shape to get in shape.
Yes. Right.
And that, I think, might be where he's at, and that would be the part, because it's the hard, long drudgery of a training camp, staying focused and staying disciplined, and especially doing that when you don't have to.
Yes.
Financially and every other way, you don't have to do it at all. You could just decide, like, all right, screw it, never mind. And to see if he's able to do all that, I'll be surprised. I'll put it that way.
That's just your body. Like, what? How much can it take? We see, like, the breaks have happened a number of times with his body. It's just your body will give in eventually, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But who knows? Patchy Mix had a bit of a situation with the French MMA. People. So last year in May, he fought someone, and they're trying to ban him now for marijuana use. And I gotta say, I did not see the marijuana use initially, and I was like, is this explaining all of these performances we've seen in the UFC? Turns out I was completely wrong. But I believe we have the Tapology did a big old thread. I'm going to try and give you the spark notes of it because it is furiously long. Received notice of a failed drug test for athlete Patchy Mix related to his May 2024 Bellator fight against Magomed Magomedov in Paris. Mix originally won the fight via split decision. The French MMA Federation, a federation that is a legal authority over MMA fights in France, has communicated that the loss, that due to a failed test, Mix's win is being overturned from a win to a loss. This is not the first reverse to a loss we have received from the French MMA Federation, but it is the most prominent. Tapology does not overturning wins to losses in such circumstances. That's a mistake they have there. The approach we are accustomed to in MMA is for wins to be overturned to no contest. So yeah, that's basically the situation here. They've said they're putting it to a loss. Tapology not following that protocol. It feels a bit much ado about nothing after all of that. And we did hear what Patchy had to say, I believe, Jordan, if that's correct. Do we have something from him? Yeah. Don't let them confuse you. I ain't a fucking PD cheat, and I work my ass off to be where I'm at. We ain't done. The road looks rocky after some losses, even non-existent at times. But a kid like me from Angola, raised by my adopted mother of four off food stamps, and no car can make it through the storm. I know we all can. Stay with me, please, as these next moments will be iconic. Not a great time for this to happen, I would say, for Apache, right?
But it is misleading to be putting out these headlines that are just like drug test issue for, you know, overture. Because that's like if somebody were like Pete Carroll having legal issues and hot water with the law, and you find out he got pulled over for speeding. You know, like,
right.
Especially this, honestly, when I saw this and I looked into it and I was like, oh, marijuana? We're talking about marijuana? It reminded me of the insane days when people's wins would get taken away from them over marijuana.
Or Diaz, and there were, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Nick Diaz Takanori Gomi fight is the greatest no contest of all time. because Nick Diaz goes out there, has a great performance and wins, and then the Nevada Commission is like, no, he had marijuana in his system. Now, that one, I remember they did at one point try to say, like, he had so much marijuana in his system, you know, but still, that was insane that we were doing that for as long as we did, especially knowing that it does not have performance-enhancing capability. It stays in your system for a long, long time after it is active in your system. And if anything, don't we want professional fighters to get home after a long, hard day at the gym and, you know, hit the bong and watch cartoons rather than pop pills and go out to the club? You know, that's just better for everyone. It's better for society to have those guys stoned at home playing Xbox. So it's crazy to me to even that we're in the year 2025 even talking about this stuff. And also the way the commission here seems to have handled it. Credit to Tapology for being like, we have seen your request. We have denied it. We're keeping that one as a win. Moving on.
That's funny, man. You know, going back to that Magomedov fight, though, like, I did suspect the evil hands of marijuana. I got to say, like, if you go watch that fight.
Wait, Chuck is like, this I don't want
to speak to someone walking down the street. Like, I mean, what are these guys doing? Like, they're going to fight a person? How is this a performance enhancer? I'm going to scale this fence and fucking run home.
I'll tell you what, I've been in plenty of jujitsu gyms where everybody's gi smelled like weed. Know, so, exactly. Like, they're out there doing it, trust me.
Yeah, I know a few of those guys myself. Lads, we're going to take another break, but we will be back to explore any super chats that you may have sent our way. Maybe you haven't. I don't know. We will find out in 2 minutes. I wonder if, like, those football shows, like, are playing and, like, we're going to a break and it just cuts to me shouting all types of obscenities.
I'm just upset that we don't hear them talking more about the Montana Grizzlies, who are undefeated.
Oh, here we go.
Leading the Big Sky Conference. And this, I got a bone to pick with Sacramento State President Dr. Luke Woods, who I talked to. I interviewed him for my story about Combat U and their whole program over there at Sacramento State. You know, he's a fun guy to talk to. He's a mover and a shaker, a young guy for a university president out there doing stuff. So I appreciate it.
But he gets
on ESPN Radio ahead of tonight, a rare Friday night game where Sac State, the Hornets, they host the undefeated Montana Grizzlies. And he went out there on ESPN Radio and he said, oh, the Montana Pandas are coming to town.
What?
We're not worried about them. They haven't even played anybody this year. Now, fair enough. Strength of schedule maybe is not the strongest argument that the Grizzlies have had, but nobody's been able to beat them yet. They got the win over Idaho. They got with North Dakota. They're doing okay. You don't want to fire up the Montana Grizzlies. Mm-hmm. Especially,
I can see that. I can see that, Ben.
You don't poke a sleeping grizzly. It's like
Dr. Luke Woods isn't going to be down there on the field when the Grizzlies roll into Sacramento. It's going to have to be the players where his mouth is writing checks that he expects their butts to cash. And I tell you what, I heard from my good friend Chad Dundas this week that the Grizzlies went ahead and put up the pirate flag in the locker room this week. The pirate flag, you guys, which kind of means... don't really care about you guys going to class so much this week. What we care about is winning this damn
Goosebumps.
Game. So,
I'm ready.
Grizzlies are,
I'm ready.
Grizzlies are coming in there.
You're getting a phone call tonight, buddy. You're getting a phone call.
They're going to be fired up after what Dr. Luke Woods said. And I tell you what, if Bobby Houck, head coach of the Montana Grizzlies, gets the chance to run the score up on you after this, he will do it. He will be out there going for two. Don't sleep on it, man. The Grizzlies are going to come in fired up, so I hope the Hornets and all 2,000 people they get at their home games are ready for it.
I love it, man. Yeah, baby.
Fuck those people. What?
And by the way, Nico Montaño. Somebody just reminded me of, like, on Twitter. Remember, I was trying to think of this.
Yes.
Nico Montaño, she had that whole thing where, like,
champ.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. We've seen some fiascos in our day. Anyway, that's who I was trying to come up with earlier.
I've got two messages saying things about God since we had that conversation about Connor. But do we have any super? Oh, yes. Go and watch that. Is that what we're doing here? Go and watch Ariel's documentary that he did with Casey on BKFC. There's Connor in his previous life as an ungodly man. He's recorded doing an interview there. It's actually brilliant. Of so many of my old school MMA fans, they've click back in all of a sudden. They're like, holy shit, this is what I've wanted. I was like, I kind of do a show every week.
Well, and don't bury the lead. We got Casey Lydon out here on the team now. We got Casey, the goat.
Yeah.
Casey Lydon out here making actual goddamn
Mr.
films.
Fanny Pack. Mr. Yes. Fanny Pack.
They don't get any better than that in the videographer game, especially in this sport. So, man, you get that guy on the team. You got to highlight his work for sure.
They've already done the Fight Circus one as well. That's going to be wild. Like, I cannot wait. They had the Fight Circus event in Vegas.
Las Vegas,
Nice. So that's going to be absolutely mental. I think that's out next month. I cannot wait to see it.
Really looking forward to seeing what happened in the Lube boxing match that they had.
Yeah. I was an alternate. Didn't get the call at this time.
Sitting there covered in lube with your gloves on, just whoop me in.
Do we have any super chats, Mr. On Air Jordan?
Where's the guitar?
He's playing
riff.
The music. We don't get the music. We need the music.
Right. Yeah, we don't hear it. That sucks.
We need to hear the music, Jordan. Okay, can we do it again? No.
There we go. Yeah. Oh, don't deny us that. It's a shot of adrenaline.
Is that mean Florida Timberman? Is that what that name means? FL Timberman?
I think so.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's go with that.
Florida Timberman. 199, thanks very much, mate. I don't know what that number two crown thing means, Jordan. Can you explain that to me?
I don't know.
No, okay.
You're getting real distracted by all the other stuff. Just give us the question.
I think you're just supposed to focus on the question there.
Yeah. Would y'all want MMA in the Olympics? A lot of people have tried to make this happen. IMAF are the closest, and they were trying to get Sport Accord. They were trying to get the IOC on board and everything like that. For me, it's a no. I don't want this sport to be that official. You know, the Reebok kits, that was enough for me.
They have boxing in the Olympics.
That's true.
I think
that is true.
I wouldn't be opposed to it as long as people understand what you'd be getting. Like, look at boxing in the Olympics. Looks at, like, first of all, who's in it, what it actually looks like, how it compares to what the professional version of the sport looks like. They're very different. It's not going to be, you know, we're going to see Charles Oliveira out there for Brazil, you know, taking on Ilia Topuria for Spain. It's not going to be that. And as long as people understand that that's the version that you would get amateurs in a bunch of protective gear going out there doing kind of a different version of the sport, then, like, sure, I don't see any reason why it should be kept out of the Olympics if there's, like, an appetite for it. But just understand that it's not going to be like a great World Cup kind of style tournament of worldwide champions.
Not to mention, it's like, it's already kind of an Olympic setup in general as is. I mean, the globe's best fighters are fighting each other, and making an amateur ranks thing doesn't make any sense. I don't know. I've never really been sold on it. We get this question probably once every couple of years, you know, where people want to know about this. And it's never been something I really cared to see.
We even give them a gold medal. We just put it on a belt that they can wear.
True.
True. It's also like, you need government recognition for mixed martial arts as a sport for it to be an Olympic sport. And that's very difficult. Like, I mean, Ireland has started trying to get MMA recognition in 2016. We're in 2025 and it still hasn't happened. Same in the UK. Sweden is one of the rare countries that actually made it happen with IMAF.
And they were very aggressive about making it happen. I remember going to cover the UFC's event in Stockholm there many years ago and talking to the guys. You know, the Swedes love a federation.
Oh,
they love to create a federation for damn near everything. And so they were really into it and everything. And at the time, I could see the argument people were making were like, they thought the recognition that comes with being the Olympics will help establish you as a, yes, we are a mainstream sport. This is for real. This is not just some weirdo niche bullshit of people kicking each other in the nuts. Like, this is a for real sport. I kind of feel like we're already there. You know, I don't know if MMA really needs that kind of recognition, as opposed to just thinking like, it'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, that's fair. Anything else there, J-Town? Did Din Thomas forgot Stipe v. Jones happened? Jose Valencia with a fair point.
I mean, it is a good point.
At least there you had former champions, one in another division, one as a former heavyweight champion fighting. Like, at least you had that kind of going for you, even if, you know, Stipe was sort of three quarters retired by then, and John Jones really handpicked it. But at least you had that. That gave that one far more legitimacy than. You know, what I am looking forward to between Bjorn Jandaroba and Mackenzie Dern.
I actually watched it back recently, and I can remember afterwards we were kind of like, yeah, John Jones did great. Like, that, I watched it again. I think I was a bit over-enthusiastic about John Jones's performance.
He was looking there a little bit in moments here. I mean, he's still John Jones. He can still do brilliant stuff.
Beautiful shit, yeah.
He was looking a little unkish in the way he was moving around at points. And I say that as a fellow who looks pretty goddamn unctuous when I'm out there doing
so myself. Yeah. I am in the unk zone, without a doubt. Yeah, I don't know. It just reminded me of, like, when my uncles used to play soccer with me and they were really good at soccer and I was five and I was like, I can't really. And he's like, yeah, get the fuck over there. Yeah. That's what it reminded me of. Do we have anything else, Jordan? Oh, shit. Boogie, $4.99, the big dog. Is Asmal Vegan the most the UFC has been invested in a fight outcome since McGregor v. Mendez? Can you think of any other matchup on that level? That's an interesting one.
Well, they really wanted to see Francis Ngannou get beat in that last one. They were pretty invested in that. God. And, you know, to the point where Francis Ngannou's manager was like, I was getting texts from 702 numbers that I didn't have saved in my phone being like, yeah, it's all about to come crashing down tomorrow. So, like, that one, they were invested sort of against one guy.
Yeah.
But at this point, like, I think the UFC is kind of less invested than we are. MMA fans and true. Media and stuff. We want to see the heavyweight title kind of legitimized here and get back on a strong footing, which would kind of have to come from a Tom Aspinall win. The UFC, I think, is at this point where they're like, look, the money machine's going to keep turning out dollar bills regardless of who wins. I don't think that they much worry about who wins these fights anymore at all.
We just need to keep putting fights in the machine, essentially, is what's happening, right? Like, whoever. Do you think they care, Chuck? Do you think they care?
In this particular one, maybe a little bit. But I know what you're saying. Like, in general, I don't think that it has the same. Back then, it meant everything for McGregor to get through that fight. I know what he's talking about, but, like, now there might be a little bit of that, only in the sense that, like, gone, the perception is, you know, that he's a second place kind of guy. Like, he's already lost a couple. It's just you're dealing with you're dealing with something different with him in at the head of that division than you would with Aspinall, which then opens up all possibility, right? So I feel like there's probably a little bit that they want Aspinall to win that fight.
Oh, we have one more, lads. We thought we were out of town. There's more super chatters here. Hammer Parsa, great name. If that is your real name, that is fucking awesome. I believe they are Australian dollars, and we have 7.99 of them. Is UFC legally obligated to offer a certain amount of fights? That says flights. I think you're mean fights to the champions. If Tom says he wants to fight three more times, do they have to oblige? I think they have. Like, that used to be something Dana White said. We offer you three fights a year. We know the champions don't fight three times a year.
Well, these days, I think most UFC contracts are, we are contractually obligated to at least offer you a fight every 6 months. And I don't know, the champions might have different clauses and different guys could have different clauses, but that was kind of the standard way a lot of the UFC contracts were structured, was we have to at least offer you one or we're in breach of contract. And offer you could mean a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. You know, we could offer you one that we know you don't want to do. And if you say no, then a lot of the contract language would allow them to extend the contract another 6 months and just say, all right, well, hey, we did our thing. But like, if Tom Aspinall was like, I want to get these next three fights in the next year and a half, and I don't care who it is, anybody you got, offer him up there, then if he has that same language, then contractually the UFC would have to do it.
Damn.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Marab has five fights a year in his, like five defenses a year. He's set up.
There's also the problem, though, that if the UFC were to fall in breach of contract with you in that way, then they could be like, take us to court. Let's sort it out that way.
Yeah.
And that never goes well for fighters. And it's always the thing a promoter relies on, is like, we got lawyers and we don't mind being tied up in court battles for years. Do you have years of your career to waste in court? Do you have a lot of money to spend on lawyers to hope that, you know, eventually you get out of your contract by the time it's no longer good for you? It's why we see so few fighters actually manage to challenge it. It's also, you might have noticed, we're looking around at a time when we're looking at the very little legislation that exists to say what you can and can't do contractually with fighters, and the UFC's parent company has been like, we would like to change that, please go ahead and just change it the way we want, and everybody lines up to say yes sir, whatever you want. So not a great time to be challenging contracts in court.
It's almost like these contracts, like, they're not good for the athletes.
they could be better.
Right, lads, that's all we've got for you. Thank you to my fantastic co-host Ben Folks, Chuck Mendenhall, the two most legendary writers in the history of our sport. We have lots to give you over this weekend, so please come back tomorrow. We have the watch along with GC and Rick, which is always a hoot, and then we will have the post fight show with Chuck Mendenhall and me and Ariel Helwani. It's going to be fantastic. We'll be talking all kinds of shit, and then we're going to do it all again next week. We love yous all very much. Have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy the fights. I'm Petey Carroll. They were Ben Folkes and Chuck Mendenhall. On Air Jordan's here as well. And Oscar Losev. We love you all. Mwah.